What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Halper Show. So glad to be here with you, with everyone tonight. There are terrible things happening in the world, but I think it's important to cover them, obviously. And it is nice to be with other people, talking to other people, and also interviewing other people who also care about the world and think that what is happening now and the status quo is unacceptable. I'm just going to tell everyone, of course, to like the show. Please give it a thumbs up. Please subscribe. If you're not Patreon supporters, you can become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/the Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/the Katie Halper Show. And this week's Patreon is going to be the live show that I did with Rania Kallik and Abby Martin. So if you guys weren't there, don't worry, you at Patreon will be able to access that show. And I'm just going to bring on our first guest. We always love talking to him. He's a prolific journalist. His name is Prem Thakkar. He is at Zateo News, and he was previously a politics reporter at The Intercept. So welcome, Prem Thakkar, to the show.
Hello, fellow carers. Glad to
carers.
Be here.
Yeah, carers. Thank you. I thought you said cameras, but yes, no. Fellow carers, yeah. And you do have your newsletter, A Better World, right? So you do actually care.
I do. Yes, I do. As we all do.
As we all do, yeah. So I want to start off by asking you actually about something that you covered. You had an article about a change in the DNC party platform on Lebanon. This is what the platform now says. The Lebanese people deserve to live in an independent and sovereign Lebanon that is free from the grip of Iran-backed Hezbollah and a corruption-free, competent, reform-minded government focused on addressing the needs of its people. In this regard, the administration is also committed to facilitating a diplomatic resolution to the ongoing hostilities along the Israel-Lebanon border that would ensure the return of both Israeli and Lebanese families to their homes. So how did you notice this, and what is its significance?
So the language change was flagged to me by someone who's familiar with the language change. And upon first glance, the phrases that they use don't seem very out of the blue. It doesn't seem that inordinary that the U.S. might describe Hezbollah in this way. But what's notable is that there has not been language formally in the DNC platform like this, sort of describing this idea that the Lebanese people deserve to live in an independent and sovereign Lebanon, free from the grip of Iran-backed Hezbollah. In fact, this new language formally echoed the stance that the Biden and Harris administration has sort of maintained towards Hamas, for example, since while supporting unconditionally Israel's war in Gaza. And so the inclusion of this language at face, it's like, oh, you know, whatever. But when you actually consider the stakes, consider the broader context, it's quite surprising, particularly because this language, like in such specifics, has not been included in the Democratic platform since, I believe I wrote, at least 1984. And that is all the more notable because this platform was largely, in some ways, a copy and paste from what the platform was under Biden. It was a platform constructed without a very competitive primary, one that was sort of, I don't want to say thrown together, like it was very intentional, but it was put together. And nonetheless, they decided to actively include this language. And what's even more notable is that right after this language was added to the DNC platform, of course, it's a political platform. It doesn't necessarily dictate policy. Nevertheless, of course, this is a Democratic platform while there's currently a Democratic administration. That language was added just days before Israel launched what they called the preemptive strike on Lebanon a few weeks ago. And of course, as we've seen since then, just in the past week, that escalation has only rapidly, you know, increased with the pager attacks, some 500 plus people killed, 1,500, 1,600 people injured. And so the addition of this language wasn't just a sort of hand-waving inclusion of something that, oh yeah, the US believes this about Hezbollah because they believe about Hamas and so on. Like there is a sort of contextual stakes here that a lot of the experts I spoke with, you know, sort of agreed. There was, I believe, Eric Sperling of Just Foreign Policy who was telling me how, you know, given how Israel has seen how much the US will sort of tolerate while continuing to support Israel, you know, it wouldn't be surprising. I think he said it would only be a matter of time before we saw further escalation in Lebanon. And he was exactly right.
Right. Really scary. And what do you think they're trying to communicate in this language, the Democrats?
Yeah, I mean, again, there's a sort of intentionality to including something that hasn't explicitly been written in decades in the platform since, you know, the founding of Hezbollah. And another aspect of this that I thought was interesting is that when you look back at the 2020 platform, one in which there's a competitive primary, one in which a lot of discourse we had about foreign policy, but also about plenty of other spheres in American politics, were kind of much more left in nature, given the sort of competitive primary, given the sort of surrounding circumstances of COVID, of racial justice and police brutality, and so many things, so many contradictions of American society kind of fully on display. These conversations were, I think, were a bit more robust. And so mm-hmm. in the 2020 platform, I'll just pull up the exact quote here. Yes, it said that, quote, Democrats believe the United States should not impose regime change on other countries and reject that as the goal of U.S. policy toward Iran.
That wow.
Is, you know, very different than how this platform is explicitly saying, you know, the Lebanese people deserve to be free from Iran-backed Hezbollah. That is a quite striking difference, and one that I don't think, you know, should just sort of be swept aside. I think the context of the times are very notable and kind of explain a bit of how that came to be. And I think also, obviously, the specific context and specific consequence we've seen of escalation in Lebanon, this is important language.
And of course, this escalation we could see as a long time coming. In fact, you tweeted out a video of Defense Minister Yoav Gallant saying something quite significant about Gaza and Lebanon. This is from November of 2023.
Almost a year ago.
Hezbollah is driving Lebanon into a war that is likely to happen. And it is making mistakes. If it makes mistakes of this kind here, who will pay the price? First of all, the citizens of Lebanon. What we are doing in Gaza, we know how to do in Beirut.
So what we're doing in Gaza, we know how to do in Beirut.
And what was interesting about that clip is at the time and since then, you know, some have said, no, like, look, he was warning. This was like a warning shot towards Hamas and Hezbollah. And sure, I mean, that could be taken in the most generous interpretation as that. It's notable that, A, this is sort of published in HD for all to see, but B, the implication is not specifically just a warning shot towards, you know, what they see as antagonistic terrorist forces. He says what we can do in Gaza, we can do in Beirut. That implies this sense of willingness to commit indiscriminate violence. And at the time when that video was posted and when I had shared that video as well, you know, I was alluding to that point and there were quite a few people that said, no, that's ridiculous. What are you talking about? And of course, in the months since then, that warning, that fear, that concern has only been proven true. And, you know, I don't mean to say that as some sort of revelatory observation from me. These are remarks over and over again that Israeli officials make quite explicitly to the public. And it's just a matter of taking their word for it and then seeing how they then use American weapons to carry out those pledges to understand that they'll follow their word usually. If they threaten indiscriminate violence, that's because they're doing it. And I found it a little disconcerting, sort of the deference that some of our colleagues in the media continue to offer to them, or even sort of ambiguity in wondering what do they really mean. It's quite clear because we've seen it over and over again. It's remarkable to revisit that video and to see where we are now. We're not only, you know, we're seeing the fulfillment of this very scary escalation in Lebanon, and this, I'm sure Seamus will talk much more about, but also the fact that so many things we saw in October and November, especially of sort of these beginning dynamics of how first Israel would prosecute this war and violence on Palestine, and then how the United States would subsequently support it, is sort of the public pronouncements that feel so familiar. There was the video that Prime Minister Netanyahu posted the other day saying, look, our war is not with the people of Lebanon. Once we're done, you can return to your home safely. Hezbollah is using you as human shields. And there was these graphics of buildings for which there were sort of these supercells of Hezbollah hiding within residential areas. And just the sheer familiarity in knowing that exact type of video was shared in October, November, and December, only for us to see what would then happen. Again, supported by the U.S. government and also sort of affirmed or tolerated or sort of let go passively by, again, our colleagues in the media. It's scary. It's scary just as a human being, let alone as a member of the media who has seen this before.
Well, you have another article, because I did say you were quite prolific. You have another article that you published, I believe, just today, and it's called Anatomy of a Smear. And it looks at the treatment that the media has subjected Rashida Tlaib to. Let's just take a look at your article, because it offers a timeline of what happened to Rashida Tlaib. So here it is. It's called Anatomy of a Smear Campaign Against Rashida Tlaib, a step-by-step breakdown of how a lie started, spread, and was picked up on by elected officials and high-profile journalists. Okay, so I'm going to go through some of the things that happened, and then we're going to take a look at some videos and tweets and stuff. So this is going to be a great interactive ride. Okay, so earlier this month, September 12th, the Michigan lawmaker, Rashida Tlaib, called out her state's Democratic Attorney General, Dana Nessel, for announcing charges against 11 pro-Palestine protesters at the University of Michigan. Okay, and here is what she said. Instead of getting justice, not one criminal charge in the Flint water crisis, you're going to spend time in trying to use the power of your office to silence people's First Amendment right. Now, it's notable that Dana Nessel, in addition to being a smearer, as we'll see, she also helped tank the prosecution of Rick Snyder, the Republican governor of Flint, Michigan, who played a key role in poisoning the people of Michigan. Okay, so then she also says, Tlaib, this is a move that's going to set a precedent, and it's unfortunate that a Democrat made that move. You would expect that from a Republican, but not a Democrat, and it's really unfortunate. We've had the right to dissent, the right to protest. We've done it for the climate, the immigrant rights movement, for Black lives, and even around issues of injustice among water shutoffs. But it seems that the Attorney General decided if the issue was Palestine, she was going to treat it differently. And that alone speaks volumes about possible biases within the agency she runs. Okay, so there she is suggesting a bias. She's suggesting what's different about this is that it's about Palestine, right? Now, to understand what happens next, we have to look at a very vile cartoon that was published, a racist editorial cartoon. It's a cartoon of Tlaib, and it says, odd, my pager just exploded. And it's a reference to the terrorist attack on Lebanon launched by Israel, and it appeared on the National Review website, but it was created by Detroit News staffer Henry Payne. Okay, so now, it's a great thing to push back on a racist, Islamophobic, heinous cartoon, right? So Dana Nessel decided that she would show her solidarity in an interesting way. So here's how she responded to that racist cartoon. She tweets out, Rashida's religion should not be used in a cartoon to imply that she's a terrorist. It's Islamophobic and wrong. Okay, so far so good. Good job, Dana. Just as Rashida should not use my religion to imply I cannot perform my job fairly as Attorney General. It's anti-Semitic and wrong. Okay, first of all, she makes it about herself. The story is not about herself. It's about Rashida Tlaib. And she also lies by saying that Rashida Tlaib mentioned her religion at all, which she did not. There's not a single quote where Rashida Tlaib mentions the fact that Dana Nessel is Jewish. I assume she probably didn't even know she was Jewish. But don't worry, guys, because Jake Tapper has Dana's back. Let's take a look at this clip. Trigger warning of Jake Tapper talking to Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer.
But do you think Attorney General Nessel is not doing her job? Because Congresswoman Tlaib is suggesting that she shouldn't be prosecuting these individuals that Nessel says broke the law, and that she's only doing it because she's Jewish. and the protesters are not. That's quite an accusation.
So Tapper does that segment. Then what's really cool is that someone from the outlet Jewish Insider reports that Whitmer didn't, quote, speak out against Rashida Tlaib's insinuation that the AG changed campus demonstrator because she's Jewish. Tlaib also claimed that Nessel is only charging the protesters because she's Jewish, says the Jewish Insider. And again, there's no evidence that she did that. Absolutely none. Okay, so then what happens? Then our friend, good friend, Jonathan Greenblatt of the ADL, tweets out something condemning Rashida Tlaib. And of course, Jake Tapper boosted that and tweeted out ADL response to Whitmer on State of the Union today. Okay, now, the Robin to Jake Tapper's Batman is Dana Bash. We've covered Dana Bash and Jake Tapper on the show before. They're both incredibly biased and very, very, very dehumanizing of Palestinians. Let's take a look at what Dana Bash did.
Now to a sad reality, and that is anti-Semitism is everywhere. And it comes from both ends of the political spectrum. But politicians sometimes sidestep calling it out when it comes from a member of their own party. We saw two examples on State of the Union yesterday. First, with Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, when my co-anchor, Jake Tapper, asked about a Democratic congresswoman's accusation that the state's Jewish attorney general was letting her religion influence her job.
Again, that was not said, right? But she's going to repeat. I'm going to spare you guys the seeing Tapper again. Then she compares it to this, okay? As if this is related. So that's one example of people not calling out anti-Semitism, according to Bash.
Like I said, Jake, I'm not going to get in the middle of this argument that they're having.
And then there was this exchange with Republican Senator Tom Cotton.
Are you comfortable with that? With Donald Trump saying if he loses preemptively, it's the fault of the Jews, a group already experiencing a rise of anti-Semitism in this country from the left and the right, but still preemptively, it's the fault of the Jews?
Well, Jake, Donald Trump has been saying things like this for at least 11 months since the October 7th attack.
I've never heard you say anything like that. If we lose, it will be the fault of the Jews.
But Jake, Donald Trump, again, has been saying for months that anyone who cares about Israel, anyone who cares about the fate of the U.S.-Israel alliance should vote for him.
I'm talking about Jewish voters who vote for any number of reasons on any number of issues.
And he was at an event talking about combating anti-Semitism here and around the world.
Just yes or no. Are you comfortable with him using that language?
Jake, it's the same kind of language he's been using for months.
That doesn't mean it's okay.
Yes, but it's his point. His point, Jake, he's the most pro-Israel president we've ever had.
Now, Jake asked that question over and over again. Senator Cotton never answered. Now, Cotton has spoken out when it appears to come from the political left. He actually tweeted, "There's no place for anti-Semitism in America," when Jake posted about people harassing yours truly at a book event.
Okay, because, of course, Dana Bash was interrupted at a book event because she does things like claim that Hamas rapes its captives without any proof. Because she does stuff like not cover the fact that Israel does rape people, which we know because it's documented on video. So Jake Tapper defended Dana and said it was because of her anti-Semitism that she was interrupted. So let's watch a little bit more of Dana Bash.
And David Chalian is back with me. I was grateful for that, as anybody who is the subject and the victim of anti-Semitism, or any other hate. And the key is, which we have learned the hard way, is you got to call it out no matter where it comes from.
You got to call it out. You don't have to have evidence of it, but you should be calling it out even when it doesn't exist. Okay.
What does it tell you about the inability or unwillingness to do so when it comes from a prominent person in your own party?
That you change your word. It's not an inability. Yeah. It's unwillingness. And it's because you're putting politics ahead of principle and morality. And that's what both of them did there. It's not very hard to say that Rashida Tlaib saying that Dana Nessel is pursuing charges because she's Jewish is an anti-Semitic thing to say. It is. It is not hard to say that Donald Trump should not be pointing fingers at the Jewish people if he loses this election.
Okay, so we have Jake Tapper, we have Jewish Insider, we have Jonathan Greenblatt, we have Dana Bash, and then that guy, all saying, as if it's true, that Rashida Tlaib said that Dana Nessel couldn't do her job because Dana Nessel is Jewish. And again, she didn't mention her being Jewish once. Don't worry, guys, there's a happy ending. And we're going to see some clarifications. So there were some pushback. And here are the clarifications. Here's what Jake Tapper did a full 24 hours later.
I should note that I misspoke yesterday when asking a follow-up of Governor Whitmer, who I asked about this. I was trying to characterize your views of Tlaib's comments. What do you make of those today, noting that Congresswoman Tlaib never explicitly said that your bias was because of your religion, and so it's unfair for you to make that allegation?
Well, a couple things. First of all, in 2022, when my opponent accused me of being a groomer and a pedophile, everyone understood that those were homophobic remarks because I happen to be gay.
By the way, like, there's not enough anti-Semitism and homophobia in the world. This woman has to announce that she's Jewish and gay. Just awful.
Right? I didn't have to explain it to people. Rashida Tlaib is an individual who's well known for making inflammatory and incendiary remarks that are anti-Semitic in nature. So this isn't the first time that we would have heard these words out of her mouth. I think it's very clear to everybody exactly what she was saying.
So one more clarification. I feel so much better. I mean, that's so great. Jake Tapper went from parroting an accusation, a baseless accusation of anti-Semitism, to saying, that's not my idea. I'm just quoting you. So please reiterate your baseless accusation of anti-Semitism. Now let's check out this clarification from Dana Bash.
Clarification on a story we brought you yesterday concerning Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib's comments attacking a decision by Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel to bring charges against pro-Palestinian protesters at the University of Michigan. Tlaib accused Nessel of, quote, biases. Here's Tlaib's full quote to the Detroit Metro Times. It seems that the attorney general decided if the issue was Palestine, she was going to treat it differently. And that alone speaks volumes about possible biases within the agency she runs. Now, Tlaib did not reference Nessel's Jewish identity. Her office has not responded to our request for clarity. Her allies insist that's not what she meant. But Nessel still says she believes it is anti-Semitic and repeated on CNN yesterday that, quote, clearly, she's referencing my religion.
Okay. So, Prem, talk us through this.
So, there was a few things that kind of stuck out as we went through them. Of course, you know, you showed things as they were. Firstly, with regards to Rashida Tlaib's comments, there have been some that have said, oh, but, you know, she just said biases. She didn't necessarily say exactly where those biases came from. As you alluded to, she was talking about how it seems as if this office is responding more heavily towards pro-Palestine protesters than to other protests in the past. Moreover, Tlaib, in the original interview, for which that interview was then sort of twisted and led to this cycle, she also mentioned in that original interview this idea that perhaps the university officials pressured Dana Nessel's offices to proceed with these charges. And so she wasn't necessarily just only going after Dana Nessel. She was actually making a it seems like a broader structural, systematic critique of sort of institutions in America and perhaps their anti-Palestinian bias. And that isn't me editorializing. That is me looking at her exact language of saying, yeah, like, I think the university officials pressured the office to do this.
Wait, people may not be used to this. So Prem is actually representing reality. So Prem may not look like a typical journalist, because as we've seen from Jake Tapper and Dana Bash, that's not what they do. They obviously make stuff up. So I just want to make sure that people can follow what you're saying, despite the fact that it's not defamation, but it is journalism. People may think these days that's what journalism is. Okay, sorry, keep going.
That's okay. So there is that basic feature that I think is worth noting. There was another aspect that I thought was interesting, which was in that conversation between Jake Tapper and Senator Cotton. Where, of course, you know, Cotton was trying to defend these, you know, awful remarks from Trump, where he keeps saying over and over again, you know, there's something wrong with Jewish people if they don't vote for me.
Right.
Of course, that's a very gentle paraphrase of some very vicious things he says.
Right. He said there's that not only is there something wrong with it, but that if he loses, it'll be because of them.
Yes. And Jake, to his credit, you know, mentions, like, look, like, first of all, it doesn't matter if he said it for 11 months. Like, it's messed up either way.
Right.
B, Jewish people have opinions on any number of things, not just Israel. And so it shouldn't matter if Trump is the most pro-Israel president or candidate in the race, because like Jewish people can have opinions on many things, which again would underscore the idea that support for Israel is not equivalent to Jewish people's identity. Right. And so it was interesting to sort of see him kind of, I think, rightly, you know, confront that issue when Tom Cotton is making these ridiculous claims by saying, no, it's fine because Trump is so pro-Israel. But it's like, no, but he's saying just awful things about Jewish people. So that was one just interesting aspect of that interview that I think it's good to see.
It's almost like Jake, for the first time ever, got that being Jewish is not inherently linked to supporting Israel.
Which is, yeah, it's important because as we've seen, so much vicious anti-Semitism comes from that premise.
Yeah.
And finally, one aspect that I think is just worth noting with Dana Nessel's response in the follow-up interview was when she sort of cited what she called inflammatory, incendiary, anti-Semitic in nature comments that Rashida Tlaib has made in the past. Of course, many times these comments that she's accused of making that were also anti-Semitic in nature were born out of cycles like this as well.
Exactly.
So it's sort of, it's interesting for, as we've seen, this was a peddled lie and a peddled bastardization of something she had said. It is notable for one to then cite previous instances of similar cycles as proof that this cycle is also justified.
Exactly.
But yeah, I think overall, I think what people said speaks for itself. Like upon, as we've done, kind of just looking at the cycle of things, which is what this article is hopefully trying to do, which is just take step by step how one claim formed into another. There's not too much else to really, you know, speak on. Like it's quite evident upon looking at how this claim was twisted and turned and amplified into something else that we see that this is, you know, not an awful pattern, but also we can understand how this has happened before. But those are just specific moments that kind of stuck to my mind as we sort of re-looked at this cycle again.
Right. I mean, I think what's really important to remember, because some people may think like, okay, well, it's bad that Rashida Tlaib is being smeared and it's obviously racist, but you know, well, that pales in comparison to seeing people being blown up in Gaza and Lebanon. But the reason that this is relevant is because it's the same media that's smearing and lying about Tlaib that lies about what is happening in Gaza and in Lebanon. And I think that it's really important to note just how brazenly they were lying and how they were so clearly not afraid of any consequences because there's just no accountability. I mean, just imagine if Rashida Tlaib had accused someone of making Islamophobic comments without a shred of evidence. It would just, you know, she'd be censored like she has been before. So I think it is a significant thing to watch. And it was also an interesting thing to watch in real time, this kind of like circle jerk, if you will, of the ADL, of Jake Tapper, of Dana Bash, of this outlet. So people get to like refer to each other and make it look like there's evidence, just like they get to refer to past smears as if that's evidence. So
Just to your point, which is, you know, well taken, is that even claims of anti-Palestinian bias, Islamophobia, anti-Muslim hate, even those when there is clear proof or even seen on video, are those seldom taken seriously. I mean, just last
week, at
the hate crimes hearing,
oh my God,
we see Senator Kennedy tell the only Muslim witness on this panel that was meant to be focused on hate crimes such as those against the six-year-old boy, Wadi Al-Fayoumi in Chicago. Months ago. Yeah, this was a hearing that was meant to be focused on things like that. Much of the hearing was instead just a very meta argument about the hearing at all, about why it wasn't focused more on anti-Semitism. But at this hearing, Senator Kennedy, a Republican, told this Muslim witness, first she accused her unfoundedly of being supportive of Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran. And after this witness, you know, kept saying like, why are you saying this? This is ridiculous. Like, you know, trying to focus on the stakes at hand, he just kept saying it. And finally, as he continued speaking over her, just said, you should put your head in a bag.
Yeah, that's how he ended it, right?
Which, I mean, in whatever interpretation you take, that sentence is horrific. And there has been no, you know, congressional response,
right,
or widespread condemnation beyond, you know, the handful of organizations and members of Congress who are willing to do so. And that is a hateful comment, a hateful moment seen on camera, which isn't even taken seriously. So the sort of incongruency is quite notable. And again, to your point broadly, whether it's Rashida Tlaib's words being taken and twisted or a hate crime hearing being taken over by these disgusting comments, both instances are moments for which the actual substance of what ought to be discussed is totally brushed aside. In the hearings instance, there should be discussion about hate crimes, about the rising level of hate in this country. I mean, in the audience, there was both the six-year-old's mom who was also stabbed. She was in the audience, as well as family members of someone who was shot at the Tree of Life shooting. And neither of those family members were acknowledged by most of the panel, especially the Republicans in this hearing. And then here, again, Rashida Tlaib's initial remarks criticizing Dana Nessel were about this the prosecution of people protesting Israel's war on Palestine and the university support for it, their tuition dollars going to this violence on Palestine. These students who were arrested allegedly by police who allegedly used batons, who used this spray called Deep Freeze, which I think, let me pull it up. It's self-described as the, quote, most intense incapacitating agent available today. And so in both these moments, they're connected to a much larger set of issues that warrants deep, candid discussion in this country. But over and over again, either those topics, to your point, are also sort of obfuscated or lied about. And then in the meantime, while these larger issues are sort of left up to debate, in the meantime, these smaller sort of narratives are then pulled out. Whether it's Republicans sort of taking over and hijacking a hearing on hate crimes, or whether it's a media narrative totally smearing Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian member of Congress. So there's this broader sort of system of distraction at play.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Distraction from genocide.
Yeah.
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 Well, I wanted to ask you about another story that you tweeted on. You didn't break this story, but it's about something that you've really covered a lot, which is the way that the media covers for the United States government covering for Israel. You tweeted out an article that says leaked docs, while Gaza starved, USAID and States Refugees Bureau came to a legally explosive conclusion. Israel had deliberately prevented food and medicine from getting in, but Blinken told Congress the exact opposite so the arms could keep flowing. So can you elaborate on this story and tell us your reaction to it?
Yeah, so essentially, I mean, shout out to this reporter, Brett Murphy from ProPublica. Excellent story, excellent work. He had described how there had been two government agencies, very authoritative agencies when it comes to humanitarian aid, that concluded in the past spring, you know, a few months ago, that Israel was deliberately blocking deliveries of food and medicine into Gaza, which is a conclusion that, you know, several human rights organizations had come to as well, UN officers as well. And so here you saw the U.S. government itself sort of saying, yeah, this is happening. And so this was a branch in USAID and then a sort of refugee bureau office within the State Department. And this reporter, Brett Murphy, reports that Antony Blinken and the Biden-Harris administration at large decided to tell Congress that that was not the case. The exact quote, I'll pull it up just to be precise. He said, according to Brett Murphy in a carefully worded statement, quote, "We do not currently assess that the Israeli government is prohibiting or otherwise restricting the transport or delivery of U.S. humanitarian assistance." And so this was a statement that contradicted both two very crucial U.S. government agencies, human rights agencies, UN bodies, international law bodies, such as, you know, the ICJ, the ICC. It's we were kind of getting used to the idea that the U.S. was operating sort of against these international bodies. But this was some real reporting that showed how specifically the U.S. government was sort of flouting its own agencies in a very particular, very direct way in the matter of weeks. And this is, yeah, I mean, truly a scandal of international proportions. We have become so accustomed to the idea that, you know, the U.S. is flouting international law, its own laws, such as the Leahy laws, in terms of being able to continue to supply weapons to a government that might be violating international or U.S. law. But it bears just sort of reiterating over and over again the stakes of those broadly. But then again, seeing this specific, well-reported out story that shows just how close these moments happen, where U.S. government bodies, including within the State Department, find a specific conclusion that says, hey, our current course of action is violating law, for then the head of the State Department to tell Congress the exact opposite is incredibly concerning. And so this was a very great story by ProPublica, and I think is something that warrants a lot of attention in the coming days from our colleagues in the media, from members of Congress. It seems, I mean, there's plenty of questions I think every member of Congress should have to answer, whether it's on foreign policy, climate change, so on, guns. But this is certainly one that has to be answered and addressed to as many elected officials as possible.
Yeah, and it's really stunning. And there's actually, I feel like there is a connection between this story and Tlaib's story, because we see such an overt dishonesty. We see that there's no accountability, and that's precisely why there can be such dishonesty. And all this dishonesty is in order to directly or indirectly really make what Israel's doing possible. Now, one more clip before you leave. Prem, you are very tireless, and I kind of can't believe it that they still call on you at these State Department press conferences. We're going to take a look at you questioning Matthew Miller about the killing of the American, as everyone in the media like to emphasize this, Turkish-American woman, Aishner, who was killed in the West Bank. Here you are asking him about it, and let's take a listen.
And finally, just on what you've said, that the U.S. is urging the Israeli forces to modify, change its rules of engagement after Aishner's killing. Of course, there's also World Central Kitchen worker Jacob Flickinger, the teenagers Mohammed Kadour, Tawfiq Abdul-Jabbar, our journalist colleague Shirin Abu Akla, peace activist Rachel Corey, 40,000 Palestinians, which of course you've condemned as well, the killing of them. The logic would follow that the U.S. has unconditionally funded a military with evidently insufficient rules of engagement up to this point. So is there any U.S. reflection on that idea?
The U.S. reflection on it is that Israel needs to change its policies, and we have made that quite clear. When it comes to the World Central Kitchen strike, we made clear that they need to change their deconfliction measures and worked with the U.N. to get new deconfliction measures in place. Now, those aren't perfect. We continue to see strikes that result in the death of humanitarian workers. We continue to see strikes in Gaza that lead to the tragic deaths of civilians. As you know, it is a very difficult place in which to conduct a military campaign, because you have a terrorist organization that embeds itself and hides itself behind civilians, which is why it's the United States that is at the forefront of pushing for a ceasefire. And when it comes to actions in the West Bank, it's the United States that's pushing for changes to the U.S. to Israeli rules of engagement.
As you point out, those attacks have still continued. So if these urgings don't continue, will there not be a consideration to condition weapons?
We continue to work to get the best outcome possible. And we believe the best outcome possible when you look in Gaza is a ceasefire.
So,
and that's why,
let me just
answer the question. And it's why we continue to work with Egypt and with Qatar to get a ceasefire over the line. Ultimately, we think that is the thing that would bring an alleviation to the suffering of the Palestinian people. Not any of the other steps we hear bandied about from time to time, but a ceasefire that brings a lasting end to the war. And when it comes to changes in the West Bank, it's the changes that we've proposed with others.
Wow. How come he keeps calling on you? You are very polite. You're very polite. You're not confrontational at all, but... What made you ask that question? What did you think of his response?
What had prompted that question was, earlier in the conference, he had said, and I think this is something he was starting to get at throughout the week, is the idea that the killing of Aishnur Egi in the West Bank showed that Israeli forces were needing sort of an increase of standards of engagement, essentially. And the U.S. was urging for a change to those standards of engagement. And so that question was pretty much saying, okay, you're saying this, given all of these killings, specifically against Americans, let alone tens of thousands of Palestinians up to this point, that suggestion would imply that given the U.S. has unconditionally supported Israel largely up to this point, and given the idea that Israel needs to update its standards of investigations or engagements, rather, that means that up to this point, if Israel has had a sort of insufficient level of standards, the U.S. has been supporting an insufficient military unconditionally. And so that was sort of the inspiration for that quote question. I think it is interesting that the State Department is more openly saying that idea that, yeah, that this embodies an Israeli military that is insufficient. But as many have said over and over again, words only mean so much. I mean, in the same way that it seemed like there was a sort of rhetorical and meaningful shift when this administration started saying the word ceasefire, you saw in that clip, now the word ceasefire is kind of used as a word to sort of bat away ideas that perhaps there should be conditioning of aid to Israel. So there's kind of this continual kind of appropriation of sliding goalposts, not an actual substantial consequence of those shifting goalposts, but allowing them to shift in such a way that then the language can be used to sort of communicate movement while actually not changing policy. So I think that was an answer that kind of illustrated how this administration has continued to do that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's disturbing, but it makes sense. Well, Prem, thank you so much. What anything else you want to let us know about? Anything new you're working on? If not, just come back when you have another story. The door is always open for you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, firstly, just appreciate you inviting me. Appreciate everyone who supports what we do and what you do, of course. I guess one plug I would have is that I just launched a new column for Sadeo as well, which we published the first one last week on Friday on immigration and sort of the lackluster liberal defenses that are used to defend Haitian immigrants and newcomers generally to this country. I would recommend you all check it out. Please let me know how you feel about it. And that column will continue going every week along with my regular reporting. But otherwise, just thank you very much. I hope you have a wonderful evening, all of you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on, Prem. And would love to see you again.
Likewise. Take care, everyone.
Bye. 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 All right. That was great. And we're going to keep the show going. So we are bringing on our next guest. And I'm so excited to be bringing this person on because he's making his debut on The Katie Halper Show. Seamus Malakfazali is a journalist who writes for places like The Baffler and The Nation. And he covers the Middle East and the Global South. So welcome, Seamus.
Happy to be on.
Thank you for coming on.
It's a pleasure.
So tell us, first of all, what brought you to Lebanon in the first place? How long had you been living there and what had you been doing there?
I had initially gone to school in Beirut a few years ago while I was still doing an undergraduate education. And I fell in love with Beirut completely, honestly. I mean, it's right on the Mediterranean, beautiful city, deeply involved in its politics, in its history. It was magnetic. I always dreamed of moving back. And then in August 2023, I got my opportunity to move there. And then once October 2023 rolled around, obviously conditions changed there. So I had been living there almost full time for just over a year. I had to leave only a couple of days ago.
I guess I wanted to ask you about, I mean, kind of a general question to discuss what is happening right now, what the latest news is. I mean, the last 48 hours, there's been a major escalation, over 500 killed and the most massacred in a day in Lebanon since 2006.
Yeah, I mean, I had left Lebanon on account of the fact that it was clear that this round of escalation was going to be more different than the other ones. I had felt this kind of this worry and anxiousness before, but never like after the fact of the pager attack, something completely unprecedented in every way, shape, or form. After that happened, the airstrikes from Israel became so immense. I mean, we're talking about I want to say literally thousands of airstrikes occurred just yesterday on southern Lebanon, including at least one in South Beirut. Just total carnage. And that was, of course, met by Hezbollah coming in, bombing places that they had never bombed before, even, I believe, during 2006, going towards Haifa, bombing West Bank settlements, which I haven't even conceived of them doing in really any conflict scenario. Again, this entire conflict has been a long procession into uncharted territory, in which we continue to break precedents in ways that I can't predict after a certain point, at least the certain specifics of where things go.
How did you experience these attacks? Where were you when they happened?
I didn't live in South Beirut. I lived in a neighborhood that was in southern Beirut, so I didn't hear much of it. But within Beirut proper, there were, of course, ambulances going up and down blocks. You could feel that there was something amiss, even if many of the Patriot explosions didn't happen inside the city itself. But I did know journalists who were at least at the funeral for some of the children who had been killed, some of the healthcare workers who had been killed. And when the walkie-talkies exploded, they witnessed those. I mean, people's hands being blown off, smoke rising from the crowds. These things were designed to create situations in which crowds would attract them and then cause carnage within that created chaos.
And what did you think of the way the media covered this?
It was completely atrocious. I don't think that's terribly surprising, but it was throughout all of the coverage of Gaza in particular, there has been this desire to swallow up the joy that certainly exists in the minds and the hearts of you know, pro-Western media figures, because of how bad the carnage is, how bad the destruction is, how much killing there has been. So they have to dress it up in obfuscatory languages, like they don't really want to do it. But with this, it's all out there. All the joy, all of the wonder at the ingenuity of the Israeli army, that's all on the table. So you have, you know, even ostensibly neutral, objective outlets in the New York Times talking about how ingenious this was, how it's an example of strategic prowess on the part of the Israeli army. It's something that sounds like it's out of a spy thriller. So therefore, they can take that and they can add a bunch of superlatives to it, and they could portray Israel in a better light than they otherwise would be able to.
There are a couple of disgusting examples, and people were making all these great jokes about, I guess, people's genitals being exploded. Bunch of people on Twitter making jokes about this is gender reassignment surgery. Even like a pediatrician made a joke about that. So I think we're seeing, I mean, it's such a masks off moment where you see people celebrating carnage. I was curious if any examples kind of stood out for you of media outlets or any tropes. I mean, one that stood out for me is the way this was presented as a Hezbollah pager attack, which meant that if you weren't paying attention, you may have thought it was Hezbollah who had done it.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the most egregious examples you're talking about, these are just random Twitter users. There's a lot of them, mind you, way too many of them. But for the most part, within the media, it was mostly things that stuck out to me was this total paving over of really any of the civilian casualties, of which there were quite some. I mean, in the Atlantic in particular, it was automatically paved over to every single one of these wounded. So thousands of Hezbollah fighters were wounded. If you had read that and you had only read that, you would come away with the assumption that this was a highly targeted, highly specific attack that, you know, only targeted the absolute worst of the worst. Therefore, how can you really object to it unless you're a terrorist apologist? Meanwhile, I mean, I personally assume that this is more of a targeted attack. But that assumption only lasted about 5 minutes, maybe 10. Once it became clear of the scope of it, where these attacks occurred, where they were blown up, it became really clear that they had no idea who had these pagers, where they were at the time, anything about them other than the fact that they were in somebody's possession. So that meant that, you know, these went off in grocery stores, these went off in marketplaces, these went off in people's cars, in hospitals, regardless of who they belong to. You know, you really, like, are you really about to make the claim that a little girl who is holding a pager in her hand that belongs to her father when it gets blown up, that that is a Hezbollah fighter? If you made that claim about, if we were to reverse this and say that this was an attack that was directed to Israel, and you wrote that down, and the exact opposite situation had occurred where, let's go even further, let's say the daughter of an Israeli soldier had the pager window exploded. If you paved over that, you would have been railroaded by everyone for erasure of civilian casualties, of the injuries of children. But in the case of Arabs, when they're affected by it, that's no matter.
And then you have the it's the father's fault. We got some of those.
Oz Chatterjee, I remember this.
He wasn't the only one, but he's like the gift that keeps on giving.
God.
It was a common thing. I mean, this because of this like utter dehumanization of Arab life that you're referring to, people don't even know that what they're saying is so offensive.
No,
it's acceptable.
When you have created such broad generalizations, when you pave over all of the complexities that exist in Lebanon, you eventually get to a position in which, okay, if it's targeted at the bad guys, that we were told are the bad guys, then anything that is done in pursuit of that objective is fine, is acceptable. Especially considering like everything else bad that has happened during this war, like in Gaza, where you saw how you know there's no you can't even make like a serious claim that it's highly targeted, highly specific, unless you're a total IDF apologist. Here you might be able to make a claim that, oh, this is how it should be, this is how it ought to be. And therefore pointing out what's wrong with it, you're taking out of line in some way or another.
You talked about the joy that people are demonstrating. And one of those people is Senator John Fetterman. Here he is sharing his thoughts about what Israel just did in Lebanon. Let's take a look.
This week, as you know, a new front opened in the war in the Middle East, jeopardizing ceasefire talks. Senator Bernie Sanders accused Prime Minister Netanyahu of sabotaging a deal. Take a look at what he said.
Every time a deal appears close, Netanyahu moves the goalposts, introducing new demands and torpedoing the deal. It is clear to me that Netanyahu is prolonging the war in order to cling to power.
Senator, you have stood firmly behind Israel, but do you agree with any part of what your colleague, Senator Sanders, said there?
No, not at all. And I want to be very clear. I thought what Israel chose to do about blowing up the pagers and then walkie-talkies, and then after targeting and eliminating membership and leadership of Hezbollah, I absolutely support that. In fact, if anything, I love it. And Israel demonstrated that they will not allow terrorists not to be held accountable. And I fully support that. And it's not about nothing that has what my colleague has said.
He loves it.
I had seen this. I had heard about this clip, and I knew it was on the Patriot Act, but I didn't know that he included the strike in South Beirut, which absolutely, like, it killed entire families, buried them under the rubble. I believe some of them are still missing under that rubble. Killed way more children, killed way more women than the Patriot Act did. But doesn't matter. It's against Hezbollah. It's against the bad guys. He was for absolutely everything that happened in Gaza. Why would he change his opinion here? I don't know if this is a related, part of this conversation, but I'm still very confused as to why he's part of the Democratic Party. Yeah. With all honesty, he doesn't seem to be in alignment with even more conservative members of the party on this. He's gone completely in an insane direction on this.
Yeah, world. We're gonna watch someone who actually is part of the media who may actually bring us some joy, because she's a rarity. And this is someone who I think is a mutual friend of ours, Rania Kallik, Beirut-based Lebanese-American journalist. And she actually, we were in the show last week, which was great, at the People's Forum. Me and Rania Kallik and Abby Martin and I were in the show together. And she also made an appearance on Piers Morgan's show.
At what point do Arabs get the right to defend themselves? At what point?
And this is, by the way, Rania talking to Alan Dershowitz at this point.
I'd like to ask you, at what point do Arabs get the right to defend themselves? At what point does our security matter? Israel has spent the last almost 12 months carrying out a genocide in Gaza. They've killed over 41,000 people, and we all know that's a huge underestimate. Over 16,000 children.
Who started that one?
Just today, Israel has killed 300 Lebanese people, including 21 Lebanese children.
Who started that war?
At what point do we get to defend ourselves? And Alan, come on. Israel's been massacring and occupying and terrorizing its neighbors for the past 76 years. Israel needs to stop terrorizing its neighbors, stop being an apartheid settler colony, and maybe its neighbors won't fire at it because its neighbors are defending themselves against an invading and occupying state.
All right, so who's right? Is it Rania Kallik or is the Dersh right? Does Rania Kallik need to leave Israel alone?
I will say one thing. One, love Rania. Just saw her an hour ago. Great lady. I would say that Rania is correct in this matter. And Alan Dershowitz, the man who just defended P. Diddy a few hours ago, is not correct in this matter.
Wow.
I mean, the question of like Arab security, we can talk about it within the realm of buzzwards and inverse relationships, but I think we should discuss in this matter, like, what would Israel accept as security? Because we might say that, oh, like, if Lebanon stops firing rockets, if there's a rocket fired from Lebanon, they'll be fine. If there's no rockets fired from Gaza, it'll be fine. West Bank, whatever. But the people who make the decisions in Israel, the current faction that has all the weight on power, is the far right. And the far right do not see peace as an option. They see the conquering of southern Lebanon, the conquering of Gaza and the West Bank as active goals. They want that for settlement. And even countries that have peace treaties with Israel, Egypt, Jordan, these are still countries that are eyed as future fronts by the religious right. Just a few months ago, one of the cabinet ministers, whose name escapes me, he is in the government. He is a government minister, was sharing posts talking about the Sinai as future Israeli territory, because they had already held it back in the 70s. All of these states were invaded and had their territories occupied based on the idea of protecting Israel's security. And in almost all these cases, they went in for settlements later. It's not a real concern. The idea is that settlement is the end goal of all of this. It's what Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister, says, that settlement is the only guarantee of this. That's what others say. This thing of, security being the one and only thing, that is something that is explained by Israel's defenders abroad. When it is explained to Israelis inside the country, everybody knows what the game is. It's about settlement. It is about securing new territory for the land of Israel, for Israelis to settle in and to expel the Arab population, or to minimize the Arab population, which is something that Smotrich has again explicitly alluded to have a small enough Palestinian population in Gaza that settlement can be possible. It's not a real thing. It is a deliberate obfuscation on Dershowitz's part.
All right. Well, in case we needed any evidence of that, this is a clip that I really hate you. I'm not saying that. That's the Twitter handle. I really hate you tweeted this out. And it's of Israeli Minister of Education, Yoav Kitch of the Likud party. He's talking on the Netanyahu affiliated channel 14. Let's take a listen at what he has to say.
There is no difference between Hezbollah and Lebanon. The way things are progressing at the moment, Lebanon will be annihilated. And I say this even now in a very blunt way. We are in a type of event where Lebanon is going towards annihilation, and it will not be the same Lebanon that they knew. I'm not going to deal with hunting down Hezbollah's rockets. The price of aggression from Lebanon's territory will be paid by the state of Lebanon.
All right. So can you unpack that and the interesting word choice there?
See, again, this is the thing about what Israeli politicians say to the American public and what they say to Israelis themselves. Netanyahu put out yesterday a message to Lebanon, which was in English, which a lot of Lebanese people speak English, but the people inside of Lebanon, broadly speaking, do not. And the idea is that, you know, we are not at war with you, Lebanese people, we're at war with Hezbollah. But when Israelis talk amongst themselves, there is an acknowledgement that the Lebanese people, not acknowledgement, there is an assertion that the Lebanese people and Hezbollah are one. They support the other. The Lebanese people are in league with Hezbollah, and they are an enemy to Israel. They are only valuable insofar as they can be like the phalangists back in the Civil War. They can back Israel to a hilt in killing Palestinians. The thing about Lebanon not existing, there was something that the Minister for Diaspora Affairs, who was a separate person, tweeted yesterday morning as well, I believe, talking explicitly not just about depopulation of southern Lebanon, but about Lebanon not being a sovereign state because of the prevalence of militias within its borders. He also said this about Syria and Iraq. The idea being that Israel is the only arbiter of sovereignty. It is the only arbiter of who has the right to exist. Do I think that Israel is gunning for territory in Syria and Iraq again? No. Do I believe it signals something about what their attitude is toward Arab sovereignty in general? Yes. As far as Lebanon exists outside of Israel's sphere of influence, they can't tolerate that. Everything has to be brought into that sphere of influence one way or another. It doesn't have to be territory. It can just be a government that is overzealously friendly to them. That's the kind of thing that they desire. When that isn't available to them, when the new Middle East that they wanted to create back during the Abraham Accords, that was something that was great for them. They want that to continue. They want that to expand. And the longer that is taken away from them, the more that they are disgusted, the more that they are angered, the more that they desire to take everything by force. And America has no interest in interfering with this matter whatsoever.
What can you tell people about Hezbollah? I mean, I think it's impossible to get any kind of understanding of what Hezbollah is, why they were founded, how they're seen by the Lebanese people from this media. So what do you think are the most important things that the media misses or distorts?
Well, one is that Hezbollah wasn't created out of thin air. It was created in response to the invasion of Lebanon in the 80s. That was the reasoning for its creation, is that it was fighting a foreign occupation. So everything that it does is in opposition to Israel and making sure that it is not a threat to Lebanon. One thing should be established about, like, because I get asked this in interviews a lot about, like, resentment toward Hezbollah among the Syrian population. It's more complicated. Broadly speaking, the Lebanese people do not want war. This is not a Yemen situation where you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people literally marching, demanding the expansion of war, give us a world war. It's not like that. Around the same percentage of population doesn't want war, also believes in the Palestinian cause. And if Hezbollah was able, I think there were specific poll questions saying that, like, if Hezbollah was able to fight Israel from Palestinian territory, they would support it. So even though there are a great many people in Lebanon who are critical of the party for however many reasons, because they are in government, they are an elected political party, in many respects. That, you know, there are always exceptions made for the opposition that they have to Israel. Even if they are critical of Hezbollah, they still there are still many people who support the fight that they are taking to the state of Israel. It's more complicated than just straight up, you know, Lebanon hates Hezbollah or Lebanon loves Hezbollah or anything like that in between.
We had on Useful Idiots, we had on Guy V. Francis, who I thought had a really fascinating perspective on this, because she was like, I'm Christian. I'm not, you know, like Hezbollah's ideology does not resonate with me, but they keep me safe.
Yeah, no. See, like, if I can give the perspective of the crew that, like, I would run with, you know, most of the people that I would see in Beirut, they are, you know, gay, lesbian, trans, not religious at all, very socialist leaning. But Hezbollah is the primary group that is fighting Israel directly militarily. So even if you are critical of Hezbollah, for example, about their anti-gay rhetoric, normally outside of the context of this war, when Hezbollah is firing rockets, you know, at Haifa, your opinion is going to be more complex, even if you are directly affected by the policy that they want to advocate for.
Right. Yeah, that's fascinating. You also had an article at The Nation about Western media's betrayal of Palestinian journalists. Can you share some of your observations?
There has been a lack of want from Western journalists to acknowledge Arab journalists, particularly Palestinian journalists, as equals with them, as people that are deserving of their respect. You know, when it comes to journalists who are imprisoned, for example, in Russia, they can start countdowns, they can start campaigns, they want to do everything to get them out. But when it comes to something thorny, like Israel, something that a lot of Western journalists go to support or to build the groundwork for support for, that's something that they can't deal with. So literally over 160 Palestinian journalists are killed, targeted for murder. Their journalism is explicitly voiced as a reason why they are being killed by the IDF. But American journalists are too terrified to rock the boat on that, to really dredge up like a significant opposition to this campaign of murder. And I thought it was absolutely disgusting. And it still continues. Keeps going. And now that there are journalists who are being killed in Lebanon, like one who was working for Al-Mayadeen just yesterday, I'm sure that will continue into Lebanon as well as this unfolds.
Right. I thought you had this really fascinating quote in your piece on Palestinian journalists. I think it was from Christiane Amanpour. I guess in April she said, "Journalists are not on the ground in Gaza," and of course she had to clarify that she meant independent Western journalists, because there are journalists on the ground in Gaza. They're just often Palestinian, and they are killed.
Yeah, the thing is that when a lot of Western journalists come to an Arab country or Middle Eastern country, or most countries, but in particular, this term is used in the Middle East, they want a fixer. They want somebody who can get them, you know, sources, secret sources, you know, get them close to the story. And oftentimes these are local Arab journalists who now are subordinate to Western journalists who have the platform, they have all the much more influence, they have the trust of a Western audience. But what it leads to is that you have Western journalists basically forgetting that these are people, or forgetting to mention at least that these are people. So even though there are literally hundreds of brilliant journalists, who eloquent journalists, people who are doing necessary work and bringing it straight to people from where they are, they are basically rendered insects. The idea being that if my camera, my CNN camera, cannot physically go there, then it's an information black hole. It's not worthy of discussion. And it leads to situations that I also mentioned in the piece, where Calissa Ward, can go to Rafah and say, we're bringing you an exclusive look
right.
inside Rafah, as if nobody had been showing images of Rafah before, and only Clarissa, once she got in there to one specific hospital in Rafah, was this whole thing illuminated. It's condescending, is what it is.
Yeah. And what are your predictions? I mean, having spent time in Lebanon, what do you think is going to happen? How is this going to escalate? Where are we going to see it escalate? Oh, and one question. Did it not occur to Hezbollah to increase security, like around the walkie-talkies after what happened with the pagers?
This is the thing. One thing is that maybe you couldn't predict that Israel would plant thousands of pagers with explosives, but there was what's apparent from at least what Axios was reporting was that Hezbollah people had caught on to it and were going to alert superiors, and that's why they had to detonate them. So maybe they didn't have enough time to get to the walkie-talkies to figure that out. But also, like, security among non-state actors in Lebanon, I've heard various stories about it, you know, not exactly being terribly secure. One person had told me that he had seen one Hamas official on a flight from Doha to Beirut, and he had no security around him whatsoever. He was just on a commercial Qatar Airways flight with no one around him in coach. Someone who had a very close line of communication with Yahya Sinwar, and he's just out in the open. They don't have sophisticated intelligence apparatuses. That's just how it is. So they have to do things not with the kind of advantages that Israel would have, for instance. But as for what could happen next, I don't know if there's going to be an all-out war, with all honesty, but I do have I'm fairly certain that it's going to get worse. It's going to get more intense. Hezbollah is going to fire more and more south. It just hit the most southernmost point that it had during this whole war, I think a few hours ago. Israel is going to hit South Beirut much more frequently, much harder. And I think the death toll is going to be immense, even if Israel doesn't invade. Right now, they're just seeing how far they could take it without unleashing something that could be devastating for both parties.
What do you think is guiding Israel right now? I mean, is there anything besides this desire for annihilation that they actually mentioned? I mean, on air, which was, I guess, not shocking. It would have been shocking if they had mentioned it on air in English, but.
I mean, ostensibly, they want to bring northern residents home.
Right.
People who have been displaced by the fighting with Hezbollah. But even within that range, I do wonder this, even if they want the social element, like, do they really think that they will be able to create such a safe theoretical buffer zone within Lebanon that people in the north will, one, want to return after all this has happened, but two, they will create a safe enough environment in which Hezbollah will not have the ability to fire on them anymore? You know, in Gaza, a place that has been under siege for almost an entire year now, complete siege, weapons are not getting in there. They continue to fire on border communities like Ashkelon, like Nir Oz, almost daily with rockets that set off alarms, that set off sirens. That is a place under complete siege. Lebanon is under no such siege. It will never be under such siege. It has continuous borders with Syria almost around the entire thing. And they are very willing to transport weapons through those borders. I don't think anything logical is like logical in the sense that it makes sense will guide it. I'm sure they think of it as logical, but these are processes that can't be achieved. But they have no off-ramp here. What is the off-ramp? The off-ramp would be to abandon this entire enterprise and to achieve a ceasefire, but Netanyahu has no intention of doing that. No other politician in the Israeli government wants to do that. It would be an abrogation of the whole thing. There is no safe face-saving measure.
And what else are people saying kind of on the ground? What are your friends in Lebanon telling you right now?
People are fearful. People are very scared. I knew of a lot of people who were coming from southern Lebanon who just one of the most stressful experiences I could possibly imagine, like a 2-hour journey from the south into north, so they're becoming 13 hours bumper to bumper traffic as Israel is bombing all around you. No, it's Lebanon has built up a lot of resilience to all kinds of conflict. I mean, people would contact me after all sorts of events that were happening, and they would be shocked when I told them that, no, everything is continuing as normal. You know, schools are open. I can go get dinner if I wanted to. I didn't really hear much of anything. But now the schools are closed. Shelters are being opened. The social fabric is sort of starting to fray at the edges of it. And if that's happening to a country that has been subject to all sorts of war throughout the years, that indicates to me something dire.
Well, you've been so generous with your time. Any final words that you'd like to share? I mean, please come back. Final words for this interview. Sounds a little dramatic when I say final words. Nothing bad's going to happen to you.
I know this is a given, but I'm just shocked that this has gone on as long as it has.
Well, actually, let's go out on a happy note and return to Rania Kallik. This is a real doozy. Watch what she has to say to Alan Dershowitz. This is from the same Piers Morgan appearance.
No, Alan Dershowitz has spent his entire career justifying Israel murdering Arab children. That's when he's not busy defending pedophiles and rapists like Jeffrey Epstein and Harvey Weinstein. So I'm not surprised that he's
gonna
come on this
program today. Okay, so we're going
to get into personal attacks now. Let me finish, Alan.
Yeah, well said. Yeah. I know. It's interesting. He doesn't even deny it.
Attacks. Oh, my God.
Yeah, because he's on the record defending.
He's
got to
protect his client.
He's on record defending Epstein. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That was a great moment. Rania did very well on that. Well, thank you so much. And people should follow Seamus on Twitter, check out his articles, and please come back.
Of course. Of course. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on. Have a great night. Bye. That was a great show, everyone. I don't want to end on a down note, but I do feel like I should share some breaking news. It's really, really, really fucking upsetting. We talked about how for the first time in a couple of decades, I think, that the Democratic Party did not put in opposition to the death penalty in their platform. And the Innocence Project tweets, "Tonight, Missouri executed an innocent man. Our hearts are with Marcellus and his loved ones. They executed him despite serious doubts about the integrity of the conviction." It's also really important, I think, to note that this execution went on despite the fact that the prosecutor, the jurors, and the victim's family all opposed the execution. So, like, for whom did this execution go on? It wasn't for the victims' families. It wasn't for the prosecutors. It wasn't because of the jurors. I mean, it's disgusting. It's absolutely disgusting. The governor refused to stop it, and then it went to the Supreme Court. DNA found on the murder weapon did not match Marcellus Williams. It matched another man. This is not surprising that Williams is African-American, and the person he was convicted of killing was a white woman. So that is absolutely awful. It's tragic. It's infuriating. But it's interesting. He actually wrote a poem I wanted to share about Palestine. It's called "The Perplexing Smiles of the Children of Palestine." Despite the actions of the few and excessive retaliation, drones, planes, bombs, tanks, rubble, buildings demolished, vanished houses and neighborhoods, hospitals targeted, UN shelters disrespected, murder, death, deliberate killing of non-combatants, babies buried alive, amputations, hunger and political starvation, lack of or no water, strategic sanitation, daily terror and terrorized daily, military maneuvering, moving here and there to return back again to nowhere, trauma with all its manifestations, international parlays and hesitation, defiance to the realization of two nations, global and thwarted, global amnesia, siblings and relatives gone forever, parental worries in the face of Apex ignorance and ethnic cleansing by any definition. Still, your laughter can be heard. and somehow you are able to smile, oh, resilient children of Palestine. So, I don't know what to say, except that's awful, terrible. Also, Missouri's governor pardoned. This is important. Missouri's governor pardoned the McCloskeys, that couple who pointed guns at Black Lives Matter protesters. You know, this guy should be absolutely shunned. I mean, this governor, he's a disgusting person. The Supreme Court also did not overturn the execution. So there, we already know that they're disgusting. His last words were about Allah. So he was Muslim. I hope it gave him comfort. I feel bad leaving on that note, but I think it's important to show it. And that governor should be ashamed. And, you know, if there was going to be an innocent person that didn't kill that woman to pay the price, he should have volunteered. That governor should have taken one for the team. Why this other guy who's innocent? Why should he have been killed?